Just another golden scepter. About 25 years ago, the entire United States appeared to be caught up in King Tut mania, and Chicago was no different. The Art Institute of Chicago was host to a traveling Tut exhibit, and the line stretched around the block, full of people anxious to see the precious artifacts. My husband had been lucky to snag a couple of tickets through an alumni group, so off we went one spring evening. There we were jammed into the other exhibit halls, thigh to thigh and cheek to jowl with other patrons pressed against the glass display cases, which held one fabulous gold object after another. I happened to be wedged against another couple, where the wife was clearly entranced by the exhibit and lingered breathlessly at each display case, much to the annoyance of her husband and those jostling behind her. "Come on, honey, let's go," he begged. "Haven't you seen enough?" "No, there's another exhibit ahead of us that I haven't seen, and this is our only chance," she replied. "I don't think we need to stay and see that. After all, it's just another golden scepter." Just another golden scepter, the word struck me as extremely amusing and sad, emblematic of Americans' appetite for wanton excess, followed by world-weary, seen-it-all boredom when it is presented to us, which only breeds a further insatiable desire for the next big thing. Here in this exhibit hall, the enduring craftsmanship of thousands of years, the vision of hundreds and thousands of slaves building a tomb laden with riches to prepare a boy king for a peculiar afterlife, this backstory was all overwhelmed by the dazzle of just too many golden scepters. Unfortunately, I agreed with my jaded wedgemate. I was ready to go. Over the years, as I have attempted to learn and become more aware of my natural environment, I have kept the phrase, "just another golden scepter," in my mind. Every day, our dear planet Earth certainly hands us a profusion of golden scepters, even as we just step outside the door. I only have to look at my dog, joyously sniffing nature's aromatic bounties, to realize this. But I am typically just too lazy and complacent to appreciate the visual gifts before me. One of the distinguishing features of human beings should be our intellectual curiosity and powers of observation, gifted us either through dumb luck, dogged evolution, or some greater power. But if we can just remember to use them, we can transform the most mundane occurrence into a marvel. Leaf through any natural history or wildlife publication, and you will find a wealth of guided trips that will whisk you off to some exotic location to plop you down in front of one of the great wonders of the world. And while I am jealous of these trips, I also realize that with a little applied brain power, I could probably find something just as spectacular, intellectually if not visually, in my own backyard. I would only have to look to Victorian England as an example of backyard natural history. The late 1800s have been referred to as the era of discovery, marked by the fruits of the burgeoning Industrial Revolution and worldwide explorations. Here was Darwin and Lord Alfred Wallace developing theories of natural selection based on observations from the Galapagos and South Seas, respectively, with collections of exotic animals filtering their way back to home port. All an enterprising Englishman would have to do is hop on a boat and travel to the nearest exotic island, and with a little legwork could probably self-name three entirely unique and glorious species. But perhaps these trips, which admittedly carried with them the threat of scurvy, bizarre tropical diseases, and death, would be akin to the adventure travel of today. And many Englishmen opted for a more local pursuit, backyard beetle collecting. In his autobiography, Darwin describes his zealous beetle collecting. "One day, on tearing off some old bark, I saw two rare beetles and seized one in each hand. Then I saw a third and a new kind, which I could not bear to lose, so that I popped the one which I held in my right hand into my mouth. Alas, it ejected some intensely acrid fluid which burnt my tongue so that I was forced to spit the beetle out, which was lost, as well as the third one." Some can find nature without ever stepping outside. In first grade, Frances had the assignment of preparing a quiz for her classmates. Each student would provide three clues to an animal. If the class could not guess, then the student would show a picture. The assembled parents were treated to the typical lions and tigers and bears, and then it was Frances's turn. At the time, I was involved in a project on asthma, and therefore had done some research on house dust mites, whose feces are a common allergy trigger. My daughter must have seen them. She stood up and said, "What has six legs, no eyes, and 2 million of them live in your bed?" The class's horror was compounded by the gruesome picture she then displayed, a magnified view of the microscopic translucent and hairy bug, and the thought of 2 million of them plus their feces mingling with you as you slept was creepily fascinating. So there you have it. You can even find nature compelling without getting out of bed. This summer, I was sitting at a picnic table eating lunch and reading a book. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a bug marching across the table toward my sandwich. I casually swept the bug off the table and then was immediately filled with remorse. I might have just casually dismissed one of the seven great wonders of the insect world. I spotted the insect squirming upside down in the leaf litter and carefully lifted it back to the table. This was one magnificent beetle, with tall legs that reminded me of the huge wheels on monster trucks that can handle any terrain. There were two long, wildly swinging antennae and large clawed forearms that must have been uniquely adapted to something. I was delighted to share my lunch with this magnificent golden scepter.